Today, I'm very excited to feature a very special guest on the pod. Meet Rick Hyen, a music manager known for his kindness and generosity. Rick, with 30 plus years of experience in the international entertainment industry, founded Music at Work in May 2014. He possesses a unique international perspective, having grown up on both sides of the Atlantic and fluently adapting to American and Dutch cultures. His career spans major labels like Universal Music Group in the United States and Europe, independent labels like CNR and V2 Benelux in Europe, and management firms such as The Entertainment Group and Montana ECI. Music at Work, his brainchild, is a management and consultancy company. It represents successful artists and producers in pop and dance music globally, singer-songwriters of all genres, and offers label services, legal support, song pitching, and publishing options for the broader international entertainment industry. Further, he is partner at Nordic Music Partners, the first internationally creator-driven music publishing company founded and run by successful songwriters and producers. Rick's story intervenes with a memorable moment we shared back in November 2000 in Sydney, Australia, when we were supposed to see a show of Blink 182 together, and eventually the universe had other way cooler plans for us to get to know each other, which I'm beyond grateful for to Rick and all people involved, including Tom, Mark, and Sky, Mark's future wife. And I'm very much looking forward to revisiting this moment with Rick for you guys today. Back in the early 2000s, Rick was working as international marketing director at MCA, one of the Universal Music labels in Los Angeles, California. And he was responsible for making Blink 182 successful outside the US just before they got into the prime of their career. Learn how Rick played a very special role in their growth as a band. And further in this episode, we will talk about how different music has been promoted two decades ago and how it works today. We speak about Rick's pivoting and him experiencing a complete setback and building his career back up, about signing the biggest record of his career so far, how he founded his company Music at Work, marrying songwriters and DJs, and we dive into mental health in the creative and music industry, and why it is super important to set your boundaries and get valued for the work you do every day. So, fasten your AirPods, everyone, and join the fascinating world of Rick Hyen with me. It's going to be a wild ride, so let's get it. Hey, Rick. So cool to finally meet you again after 23 years. Can you believe it?
Yeah. The wonders of the internet and how it brings us all back together, right?
Right.
Very
yes.
Cool.
I'm really very thrilled cool. that we have the chance to talk, because I always wanted to reach out to you. I remember that we have had some emails in the very early times of email. That was the time when we actually met. And do you think that we should give a little rundown of the day that we met from the both sides to the listeners? Because I think that would be really interesting to hear what actually happened.
Why don't you start and refresh my memory?
I will, because, I think it was, I don't know the exact day, but it was in the beginning of November. We met in Sydney, Australia, and it was, I think, very short after the Olympics that happened there. Mm-hmm. And, a bit earlier in that year, in August, I have been at the Bizarre Festival in Germany, and Blink 182 was scheduled to play there late afternoon-ish. And I remember seeing them with a friend of mine, and I told him that I really want to meet these guys. We have to talk to them. And so a couple months later, I think in October, there was a competition in MTV Germany, and they just asked the question, why should you and your best friend travel to Australia to meet the band? And I was sitting there, I was doing the civil service at that time, and I was writing an email that I wanted to drink beer with them through a funnel. And That was the only thing that I put in that email. And I think a couple weeks later, I received a message that I had won the second prize of the competition. And I said that, okay, I don't even know how to skate, but I wanted to meet them. And shit. And I think 1 or 2 weeks later, the very end of October, I got a call from MTV London. And they said that, hey, Jan, you're the one who's picked out to fly to Australia to meet the band. And I was like, all right, now we're talking. And how about that skateboard? And they, if I remember right, she said that, you know what, you can keep that. The band also wants to drink beer with you through a funnel. And I said, right on, let's do this. And she said, are you free next Thursday? And we're like, okay, because then your flights are going to go to Sydney. And I was like, okay, really? And so I had to call my friend and said that, are you sitting? Because here's the news. And then I told him, and we were about to fly to Australia the next week. And it was a weird trip, so to say, because we had to fly from Düsseldorf to London, from London to Dubai, from Dubai to Singapore, and from Singapore to Sydney. And it took like, I don't know, 32 hours to get there. And when we arrived, it was 10 in the morning, local time, and we were dead. We were dead. I didn't sleep at all during the flight because I didn't understand. We flew with Emirates Airlines back then. It was pretty comfortable. And they had these stickers that you had to put to your shoulder or to your seat or whatever. And that said, do not wake me up. And I never did. And then they always woke me up for the meals. And that was, of course, much appreciated. But I didn't know that they would actually let you sleep. And that was the fun sidekick in that moment. But then we arrived there and there was nothing of MTV. Nobody, not a sign, not anything. And just a black car coming. And there were two Norwegian girls and two Italian dudes with us that we met in London that came there with us. We were like, okay, where is this going? Because where's the camera? Something is wrong here. And so they took us to this really shitty hotel. I remember the shades were like torn like this. It was really looking weird. And we were like, it doesn't matter. We just need to sleep. And then something rang in the room. And it was you on the phone. And I had you on the phone. And you said, hey, Jan, this is Rick. Sorry, but the gig is canceled tonight. We were like, all right, really? And you said, you know what? I will come by and explain to you. And then, I don't know if you remember that, but you came to the hotel and we were sitting there. We looked like shit, I believe. I had this really badly dyed hair. It was red, reddish. It wasn't that red anymore. And so we were super sleepy, and then you said, hey, you know, let's go to a liquor store and buy some beer. And we went there with you, and I remember that we found this really cheap German beer, and we were like, okay, let's buy this one, because that was the cheapest thing that you can get in Germany, and that was our festival beer. And so we had to, you know, go full circle on this. And eventually, we were having beers with you in the hotel, and then you said, we will pick you up later in the evening. And the moment you left, we fell asleep, I think. And the moment you came back, we woke up. And someone was yelling at us, come out, we have to go to the car. And we didn't refresh us. We just had our shitty shirts on and the hair wasn't made. And we went to the black car again. And then we met you. By the way, I remember that you asked us to go eat sushi. And we said, no, we never had sushi. We don't want to eat sushi. And and then you got us to this really fancy fish restaurant, which was amazing. And we still couldn't believe it. We were all thinking that you would take us to the show now. And that was all a scam. And it's something you made it up. And because we thought that there must be a camera somewhere. Something must happen. And later we were in that restaurant, and I remember that we were sitting there with Tom and Mark and Sky, the future wife of Mark, and you, of course, and all these crew members. Just Travis was not there. He was back in New Zealand. I think you said that he had something with his leg or something. So we had this really funny conversation, and you made such an effort for us to feel good, and it was overwhelming, of course. We had the weirdest conversations with these guys about the hidden track, like, you know, what was the name of the song? Fuck a Dog, you know? Tom was telling me exactly how and why this song has been written, and and I was having a conversation with Mark about the civil service. He couldn't believe that we played table soccer more or less the whole time and got paid for that. So he was really excited about this, and then later we had that conversation with you after we had, I don't know what, so many drinks at that evening. And you said, you know, you really have a shitty hotel. I will take care of that. And I will never forget that. The next morning, you came by our hotel again, and you said that, you know, I got you guys a really nice suite in another hotel. And you will share that suite with the Norwegian girls, and I put the Italians somewhere else.
Right.
That's what you said. And in that moment, you became a legend for me. And you got us these records, the signed records of the live CD. What was that called? Right. The Mark Troman Travis Show.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Yeah. And you managed to have us in that beautiful suite for another 4 days. And I think we were in Sydney for 5 days, and then we went back home. And
that's amazing.
So that's that. And, you know, years later, honestly, I think 10 years ago, maybe, I realized that, and that's what I meant when I told you that there was a reason that we didn't see them play live, was because I wanted to have that conversation with them. That was the wish that I sent out, the energy that I sent out very heavily on that festival in Germany, that I wanted to see them and I wanted to meet them and talk to them. And it actually happened. We sit in that restroom for 8 hours, I believe, until the very early morning. And it was such an amazing and unforgettable day. And so that's how it all happened. And
it wouldn't have happened if the show was not canceled. So true, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so that being said, I wanted to thank you so much for everything that you made possible. And that was the reason why I sent out this post, because it was 20 years later, exactly on that day.
And, that's right.
And then your wife answered. And of course you. And I was so happy about that, that actually this message reached you. And then, I had the idea another year or two later that it would be actually really cool to talk to you on this podcast. And here we are. So great you're here. Thank you for coming.
No problem. Thank you for that story. It's really cool to hear it from your perspective so many years later. That's pretty special.
It is. I never forgot, of course. How could I? And
I have also my own experience of that whole trip, of course, which is quite different because it started actually in New Zealand.
Yeah, you said.
That was supposed to be the first show of the tour. And it wasn't until, like, I think the day we left to go to New Zealand was when we heard, hey, Travis is not feeling well. So he's not making the plane, but Tom and Travis are going, or Tom and Mark are going, and the crew and everybody, and we're down there, and we're just basically, we get to New Zealand, and then we spend 2 days, wondering whether Travis is going to make it or not.
Oh God!
And he never did. And then, so I had a similar type of experience in New Zealand with people that that were not from Europe, but local prize winners in New Zealand, and basically had also there like things I had to do and take care of for. With fans with no show, it was kind of a strange experience, although being in New Zealand for the first time was amazing.
I believe
I did find that fantastic. But then a few days later we fly to Sydney and we're still waiting for Travis to get better, and we're still like potentially doing the show, and I don't think it was until maybe that morning that you arrived that the show actually was officially canceled and that Travis couldn't make the flight. Just the entire trip, I ended up being, I think, on the road for maybe 8-9 days in total, or maybe 10, and no shows.
Not at all.
Basically,
okay.
just like promotional things, like you experienced, and
so you had to have a lot of dinners then. All right.
Yeah, I mean, and I remember the competition with MTV very well. I remember specifically doing it in Germany. Because that was a focus for us at the time. We didn't quite have the success we wanted yet on the continent, right? The UK, as I was explaining to you earlier, that kind of got well covered, especially because they took the time to do the Top of the Pops show, and they really spent time in the UK, and then they went back to their America. So the continent kind of got left behind a little bit. So I really remember doing specifically that MTV competition as something to really, help kickstart the promotion and get more exposure and all of that stuff. I mean, we it's a pretty expensive prize to put together, right? To take six of you guys from Europe over to this, and it's the way that works is the label pays for it, right? MTV gives the MTV pretends like they've taken care of it, right?
Yeah,
but
sure.
The label has to take care of it. But I also do remember the logistics being all screwed up, which is why I was like, "There's no way," our international department let you down and like didn't give you, they didn't get the hotels together that they normally that I would.
Hey,
I
didn't complain at all. It was such an amazing trip, and I would have slept in a tent, just to be clear.
Yeah, I know. But we didn't want that to be the thing. And on top of that, there was no show. I mean, there had to be something to make up for a little bit. So I'm really happy I was able to be there for you guys and help out. That's amazing.
You were there.
Did you end up, did anything happen with the Norwegian girls?
Now I can say no, it didn't.
Okay.
No, Connie and me, my friend, we were both very faithful. We had some longer relationships that we were in. We behaved. But yeah, still, we had a lot of fun with these Norwegian girls. We went to some really weird clubs, and there were people doing cocaine next to us, and like, "Do you want some?" And that was like, "Okay, no, maybe not." But it was really fun, and it was so exciting to explore Australia, not Australia, but Sydney. And we packed everything in these 5 days, and I remember that Connie was blown away by, I think, Mark. No, was it Tom? I believe it was Tom. He always squeezed the bottles when they were close to get empty, so that he'd get the last drop of liquor of booze out of it. And so he continued that habit throughout the whole trip. And we went having drinks and everything everywhere, and we explored the city. We went to the beaches, and so we had the best time ever. And especially with this evening and having these wonderful conversations with all of you guys, and the incredible kindness that you gave us, it was such an unforgettable trip. And I think that was so special that for me at least, I I formed this habit of giving back without asking anything.
Yeah,
and
cool.
Maybe it has been initiated there, because I believe I never experienced such kindness ever, and from people that I didn't know, right? So that was really special to me. And but I wonder, now that we talked about this day and how the both of us actually saw it, what in our pre-conversation you talked a bit about how you actually got to meet them and how you got into the position to actually work with them, and that it was quite early in their career. And would you give a little tour about that to the listeners as well?
Yeah, sure. So when we met, it was about a year after I started working as an international marketing director at MCA, which was one of the Universal Music Group labels in Los Angeles, or in America. Before that, I was living and working in Europe. I was the label manager also for MCA and other labels in Holland. That's how I built a relationship with all the people at the company. And I even met Blink once at the Warped Tour in 1998, just before I was leaving the company there for, I actually did a little other job for about a year, but I met them once briefly. Then a year later, I got asked to come and take over the international marketing director job at MCA. And I was still living in Holland, and the first day, the day before I was going to move to LA, I actually went to the Transmusical Festival in France, and I went there with our French colleague, and who I met for the first time, and we took the train out there, it was a wonderful day. We spent the whole day with the guys, saw them perform. It was really energetic. It was a very cool way to get introduced, if you will. And also because the job I was doing was trying to make them successful outside of the United States. That was my job, international marketing. So everything in America was somebody else, and I was responsible for their success outside of America. And as I got there, that was about to happen. They had just released Enema of the State. What's My Age Again was going up the radio charts in America and a little bit around the world, Australia, New Zealand for sure as well, but the Europe hadn't really caught on yet, and that was like the first big thing that I had to do when I got there. So I get to Los Angeles, and I'm like, all right, well, this record is about to blow. Now, next year, February, March, we're gonna do this European tour, and really gonna try to blow up the band in Europe. That was like that was my main job, my main focus, if you will. And then we got a 4-week tour planned for them, mm-hmm. Throughout all the countries in Europe, and it looks perfect. But like I was saying to you earlier, they weren't the biggest fans of touring in Europe at the time. And so they cut it short. They cut it down to 2 weeks. And they're like, sorry. At which point I was like, okay, some countries had to get taken out, and it was a little bit of a disappointment, but yeah, we could still make it work for 2 weeks. Flash forward a few more weeks, and all of a sudden the UK, the record is all over the radio and it's starting to really pick up. And the UK company's like, I think we can get Top of the Pops, which would be like the biggest thing that you could do at, in the UK at the time. Now that show doesn't exist anymore, but of course that was the biggest promotional opportunity. And so the way that would work is, right, you would schedule that performance in the week, the day before the record comes out, because it used to be different back in the day. You used to promote before a record comes out, and then a record comes out and everybody goes to the store. Now it's the other way around. You know, now a record comes out and then you do the promotion afterwards. It's very, very different. But that was how it worked then. And but the only thing was that 2-week tour, the 14 days that they were going to come to Europe, had to be extended by 2 days so they could do the TV show. That was a problem. So then I had to spend, days trying to figure this out. Like the manager's calling me saying, "Yeah, I can't get them to you know to agree," and I'm just like, "You got to be kidding me!" You know, and I've got all these people calling me. So finally, I had not really spoken very much to the band, like a couple of times at the you know at the French festival, and another time at a video shoot, hung out with them. But I caught Mark Hoppus one day as he was driving from Los Angeles to San Diego for about 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And I basically spent that whole car ride, you know, convincing him how important it was to take those two extra days and to do this TV show and how career defining it would be and how it will change the next 10, 20 years of his career in the UK and Europe and everything. And after, yeah, a couple hours of talking, I finally convinced him, and then he convinced the rest of the band, and they agreed. And so a few weeks later, they go off to the UK. They do the show. It's a huge success. And a week later, the song debuts at number 2 in the UK charts, and they're off to the races. And their career is especially in the UK, is forever kind of,
Rest is history.
Yeah, the rest is history.
Did they ever thank you for that conversation?
I hope to see them in a few weeks, and we'll maybe have that conversation again. I do tell the story a lot. I mean, it's my contribution, for what it's worth, right, to their career. And it was an important moment. And unfortunately, after they did the show and the 4 shows in the UK, they got sick and went home, and so the rest of the continent didn't get the tour that they were supposed to have. And so they made up for it a few 2 months later. They did a show in Milan, and I think one in Hamburg and Holland and some other place. But so it was a little bit of a challenge, because we had such a huge success in the UK, but not the same on the continent. And it's funny how that kind of led to us eventually meeting, because as I was saying before, you know, we needed to do more work. We needed to do more promotions. And we really focused on how do we get MTV on board? Let's do something in Germany. And what's the biggest thing we can come up with? Let's fly 6 people. You know, that's how that whole thing happened, is because we're, you know, really putting in the work to get more exposure on the continent for the band. So,
and I think you did well, because I remember when I think All the Small Things came out, and this music video with them doing the persiflage on the boy bands.
Yeah.
I think that was a really big success in Germany, and well, probably one of their biggest hits ever. And they got really popular in Germany, I believe.
Yeah, they ended up getting popular everywhere, pretty much. But it wasn't quite the same as in the UK, and you know, which you can't do that everywhere around the world. Of course, those are moments that you can only pick and choose. And I'm still they are very happy that they did it. I'm happy we got it done. And then Australia, New Zealand have also always been, you know, kind to them. I think also they feel like it's not too different, right, from where they come from.
Sure.
And from the musical, you know, the musical affinity to what they do, the surfing, all of that, you know, is also
beaches.
Very, not too different than Southern California. So, it's interesting. And you know, I got lucky that I was, you know, I was able to be involved at that moment in time, just as they were about to break, and I'll never forget it. And we've had, you know, great times together. I haven't I saw them once in 2008, I think, at a Lowlands festival. I saw them briefly, and once at a festival in Paris in 2010, but that for like a minute. But it's been 13, 14 years. I haven't seen them. Mark's been through shit. If you haven't heard.
I know. Sure. Yeah. I saw it.
And
he had cancer.
So, but, you know, was able to beat it enough to, you know, be back on tour. And Tom was out of the band, now back in the band.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot.
A lot has happened in those 23 years.
Yeah. Travis is a Kardashian.
Yeah,
lots of different things.
And they're touring right now, and they're doing it. So, and it's amazing to connect those dots. And so it was the early 2000s that you worked with them. And for how long did you work with them then? And what happened after 2000?
Yeah, so worked with them for a couple of years. It's funny that you, before we started this call, we had a pre-discussion, and it made me think of, we have a house in Los Angeles, in Laurel Canyon. So we have it's actually a studio and a home and a workplace for myself and for all my clients when they go to Los Angeles. And because it was too much to ship gold records all over the world, because I've been moving from the States to Europe and back. So I had all of my gold records in storage, and they're now all in this house in Laurel Canyon. And they're all like at the basement in the studio where people work. So, once in a while, people that come in are like, see these and like, oh my God, this album. And oh my God, this album. And, I worked with them on Take Your Pants Off and Jacket. And I worked with them on the Mark Chapman Travis Show and The Enemy of the State. And pretty much that whole period of time up until 2003, actually, when unfortunately, what happened was, what happens in America a lot, Monday morning email, Monday afternoon, 120 people outside with a box because they shut the entire label down.
All right.
The Universal Music Group had basically shut down MCA as a label, which had consequences for 100 plus people. And I was on a contract still at the time. So I wasn't too upset. I was like, oh, 6 months of paid vacation.
Yeah.
I don't mind. But other colleagues got two weeks or 4 weeks pay and then had to figure it out. And very rough. So, that did kickstart a whole another chapter in my life, because, I was in America on a work visa at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
I did have a green card when I was growing up, because I grew up in the States. My family moved there when I was six, and so all my family had green cards. But because I had been working and living in Holland throughout the 90s for about 6-7 years, I had been outside the country too long, so I could not keep the green card. I had to hand in the green card when I got the job in Los Angeles.
All right. So you have to be there for a certain period of time, or in that period of time, right?
You have to stay in the United States. It's a residency permit. And if you don't reside there anymore, then you don't get to keep it.
Yeah, there will be others that happily take it then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I had to come on a work visa, which made my situation complicated, because the work visa is sponsored by the company that hires. And so they just shut that whole label down. So I was basically there with a work visa from the company that just shut everything down. So that was not going to work for me anymore. And so I didn't have many options, but I did stick around. I traveled a lot. I went to Europe. At that time, my brother had just started a new band, and he was sending me demos. And I'm like, who is this? And who's this singing? And he's like, oh, that's me. I'm like, what? You sing? You sound like Chris Cornell. This is like Audioslave. What is this? And so then I flew over to Holland to go see his first show. And I'm like, oh my God, there's my little brother, on the stage going crazy and ripping his shirt off. And I was like, wow. I got so excited about that. Yes. It's like, well, I want to help you. But at the same time, I had to fly back to the States. And as I did that a few days later, I'm in San Francisco with my, Montana friends, as I called them. It's a group of people that I met actually probably only a few days before we met in 2000 at a show at the House of Blues by the Canadian band The Tragically Hip, mm-hmm. who are one of my favorite bands of all time. And it just so happens that there's this whole group of people from Montana that we met at the show, and there was 12 of them. And one of the things that I always loved was I'd been in LA for like a year by this time, and it was a lot of the things you would hear about Los Angeles, right? Plastic Fantastic, and the girls all are pretty until they start talking, then not so pretty anymore.
Okay.
And these people were all like super cool, super normal, and they're all from Montana. So I was like, oh my God, normal people, thank you. Be my friends. And they became my best friends. And it was a group of like 12. They were all spread out throughout the West Coast, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, Seattle. And they would always get together like once every other month or something and have a party or some event.
Yeah.
And so throughout the year, I would go to these events quite a lot. And when I was in San Francisco in 2003, so it's 3 years later, one of the girls or one of the people in the original group was Jessica, who is my wife's sister. And Jen, I had never met in those 3 years until that one time in San Francisco.
So you met your wife in San Francisco?
Yeah, that's where we met. And then all of a sudden I was like immediately like just so like infatuated in love, and it was really cool. Aww. Right away. And beautiful. But I was like, you know, I still had 3 or 4 months of my paid vacation, but that was running out, of course. And so she was living in Seattle at the time. And so next thing I know, I'm up in Seattle the next week and bringing her down to Los Angeles. And so, and then my brother with his band in Holland, but I really didn't have much I could do. So what I did, I put my stuff in storage. Drove up to Seattle, put some things in Jen's house, my wife, and then started going back and forth between Europe and the States, between, you know, helping my brother with his new band and trying to see my new girlfriend, if you will. And that was a tough time because I was basically living off of two suitcases, you know, for yes. a year and a half.
Wow.
With no income. Okay. Yeah. So I was basically on people's couches and, you know, and beds, my brother's couch, my friends, I'd seen like every couch around, you know, and so it was surreal, but also, you know, it was a big reset for me, you know, basically go back to the basics and start and build my career all over again. You know, it's not easy if you're like on this, you know, record corporate trajectory, and then all of a sudden, boom, it disappears.
I believe, you know? And it takes a lot of courage to go through this. Yeah. And so when you, first of all, thank you for sharing. And so then you, after you have been living out of the two suitcases and being like grounded again, so to say, what happened then? And how did you actually, because that seems to be like a very important moment in time in your career.
Yeah, for sure.
So what? Yeah, what I mean, it was not easy that you take that you
so,
took.
You know, I had an international career, and then I was back in Holland. So that was also a bit of a struggle. But I'm helping my brother's band, and we're making an album and touring with. I got them as a opening act for the band live. I got them to open up for Coldplay and some other, you know, cool things. It was all very DIY, right? And very, and like we weren't making money on it. It was just a lot of love and a lot of fun. So, you know, it was time to have a regular job as well, or a paying job, I should say. And I got this job at, this management office in Holland called the Entertainment Group, which at the time was representing four of the biggest artists in the country. Mm-hmm. And I saw some people there that I knew from like, the first time I was working in Holland in Europe, maybe 8 years before. And I was like, oh, this guy and that guy. And I found, I found a job there, heading the records department and managing some of these artists as well, which was important and good to have, you know, have a job again. And but I never felt entirely comfortable because I was in Holland, and I felt like, you know, I wasn't maximizing my my potential. But it was a decent experience at the time. And the most important thing was I needed a fixed income to also qualify for supporting a residency permit for my wife Jen, who I wanted to have move over here and be with us. But that whole process took 3 years between us meeting and her moving here in 2006
to Europe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which wasn't easy for her, of course. But you know, we're still happily married now, and
wonderful.
And she's a Dutch citizen as well, so she is both American and Dutch, and even speaks the language. No thanks to me, because we only speak English. I did not help her at all, but she managed, and that was pretty cool. Yeah. So I got, you know, I kind of like slowly built my career back up. I had this job at this management company, but I wasn't in the position to really make decisions, and I was still looking around. Then I got asked to run a record company in Holland called CNR. So I've become a managing director of a record company, an old company that's been around for many years. So my dad actually used to work at many years before. So it was kind of
so it's a family thing.
It was an honor at the time to be asked. And so I did that, but that also wasn't the best fit. First of all, it was lots of Schlager music. So lots of Dutch folk. Yeah.
All right. You're going to love that, right?
Yeah. Very much not Blink-182. And so that wasn't really so much a fit, but I saw it as still a good opportunity for the experience.
Sure.
But also, you know, 6 months into that job, I'm like banging my head against the wall because the people are not doing what I'm telling them to do. And I could not figure out what was going on. This was another key moment in my life. I realized after a while, I'm like, oh, wait, you know, I'm approaching this like an American, because that's kind of where I, you know, spent most of my life. And even though I speak Dutch fluently, I was approaching it as a with an American mentality. And I was also asked to, you know, rejuvenate and restructure the company. So I put this whole new hierarchy together and created a whole new structure for the company, which nobody wanted to.
And that would be uncomfortable, unknown to them.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. And so there was an enormous amount of resistance.
Oh, right.
And so for me, it was a very important moment of clarity that I realized, oh, okay, I'm actually, you know, I've got a bit more American than I do Dutch. I've always said I'm 50-50 and I'm equally comfortable in both places. But that realization made me realize it's not entirely true. And once I realized that, that changed everything and took the weight off. Also made me realize, okay, I need to start doing something different then too, because, you know, this focusing on Dutch Schlager music is not going to cut it for me.
So what did you do then?
Yeah. So, good friend of mine, who I knew from when I was working the MCA label in Holland as the label manager, he was the label manager for Geffen, at the same time. So he was handling, you know, Nirvana and Beck and Counting Crows, and you know, and I was handling Bush and No Doubt and you know, Blink-182, and it was a good time. It was a really, really good time. So Chris was his name. By this time he had started his own company called V2 Benelux, and they were looking to create an international department. And so he called me and I was like, you know, okay, Dutch Schlager music over here, you know, international music department over there. That's more my style. So I went and did that and started building that with him and that company. And it was there that I signed the biggest record that I've ever been involved in.
Which?
And that is the... Yes. The Gautier record, somebody that I used to know.
Oh.
Yeah. One of the biggest hit of 2011, I think it was 2012. Yeah. And in the rest of the world. So I was the first person on that record, first person to sign it outside of Australia. Again, this is where Australia comes in. He's actually a Belgian kid that moved to Australia when he was two with his parents. Oh. And that's another interesting story of its own right about perseverance and how it's able to get that record signed. But that was a cool time. I was able to set up this international department, sign this huge record, but it still wasn't the best fit. So by this time, one of my college friends, Hugo, he calls me, and he is up in arms because he's representing seven Dutch DJs, electronic music DJs, and they're all exploding. And one of them is about to have a number one hit in America. His name is Afrojack, and my friend could not handle it by himself, so he asked me to help out. So I was like, you know what? I like dance music too. The Dutch are really good at it. America finally woke up. So that was the big difference. And when we were touring Australia, electronic music was nowhere to be found in the United States, really. And then suddenly that all changed in 2011, 2012. So I thought that was interesting opportunity to go and do that. And so I helped my friend with his company, and it was him and me and an assistant. And then a year later, it was 14 of us because it was just exploding and there was a lot of success and a lot of these DJs doing very, very well. So that was interesting too. But it still wasn't fulfilling for me because it was only DJs and only that music.
Yeah.
And I'm all kinds of music and always have been, you know. So it also wasn't covering it for me. And, you know, I didn't have something for myself. You know, I was still working for another company. And so that's what led me to start Music at Work, which is the company now it's 9.5 years, I think now. It'll be 10 years in May.
Wow.
And
congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. It's
well, tell me more about that and being your own boss.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a jump into the deep end because I'd never done it before. But I felt like, you know, by that time I was already in the business for like, you know, 18, 20 years. And, you know, I had a lot of experience to share. And, you know, I also wanted to be more involved in the whole creation process. So, you know, really the music creation process. Mm-hmm. So I ended up finding and representing also songwriters and producers and people from behind the scenes, as well as DJs and artists, but basically the whole vertical chain of how music gets from, you know, sitting in a room and a guitar and a melody and a lyric to eventually it being, you know, performed by an artist X on a record. There's a whole lot of stuff that happens in between. And at Music at Work, we kind of, you know, help everyone throughout that entire process. So, and we have all kinds of clients throughout that process as well.
Okay, and, but let's start in the beginning. So when you formed that company, you had the idea of going the whole vertical thing. Yeah. And but did it start... when it started, did you have the whole thing planned out, or did you like pivot on the way, and what happened? So what were the challenges?
No, there was a lot of discovery as we went along. I mean, so the big difference is, you know, a lot of the earlier examples, I was at corporations or record labels or big management firms. but specifically, label guy for many years, right? And so then when I started repping the DJs, it was the first time I was management guy, which, they also had some interesting learning moments. And also because all of a sudden you're on the other side of the table. So, whereas for 15 years I'm, at the label, and I have the manager, the representative of artists sitting across me and chasing me to make things happen. And, I'm always trying to do a good job for them. Now I was on the other side, which was very interesting to experience for the first time, especially because when I was doing the DJ gig with Hugo, Afrojack was blowing up as an artist, and everybody in America wanted to sign him. So he was like one of the hottest properties of an artist at the time. So I just happened to be there in the middle of that. And I'm in the head of Sony Music office one day in New York, and a few days later, I'm in the head of Universal, global office the next day.
I'm back. Hello.
Yeah, exactly. I'm back. It was in the same building that I used to work at, but then like completely on the other side, and then like all of a sudden they need something from me. It was quite fascinating.
That's how it goes. Perfect.
So I got a taste for representing the talent, and what I really liked was like being at the source of everything and really at the being responsible for just how things get created from the beginning. And so that's Music at Work became a home for all kinds of creatives, and I wanted to to be that, and so that's kind of all I knew. I wanted to be a management home for anybody, whether it's a songwriter or a producer or a singer or a DJ, even a visual artist. We had a guy that makes X-ray art was one of our clients for a while, and that was the start of it. And my logo was Music at Work. This used to have this headphone, and it just Music at Work Amsterdam, and that's how it started. And then I took one of my clients from the previous job with me, Dimitri Vegas and Like Mike, who are Belgian brothers, also very big DJ stars, who I became like the, I would call a music manager for. I was helping them create songs and finding songs and putting them together with songwriters, so basically make the eventual records. And we were quite successful with a bunch of them, actually. And because Los Angeles is the songwriting capital, if you will, for our business, that's kind of where all the work happens, and a lot of the bigger songwriters all live there. And so many people that are making music go there for a week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks at a time to work and write and compose and work together with local talent to create the music and the songs.
Hence, that's you having the studio over there.
Yes. Right, so now that came later. So after in 2015, I think it was, I counted that I went there like 8 times or something like that, because Dimitri and Mike, the brothers, they would go there 3 times a year, but so would Kimo Franco, my other client, and so would Rick Onama, another client. So next thing I know, like, my clients are going there so many times a year that I was like, you know what, I might as well just add Los Angeles to my address, to my logo. Even though I didn't have a place yet, but I'm there all the time. So I'm in Amsterdam and Los Angeles, and
sounds good.
And it looks really cool. And I remember, like, maybe 2 years later, I remember having like that realization moment when I looked at that logo and I was like, oh wait, that's me. That's, it's basically a reflection of myself. Like, I am both of those places. I am, I am Dutch and American, and it all made like kind of course, then you're like, duh, no kidding, you made a company around who you are. But it was funny to see that. I remember having that realization moment one day when I looked at my logo. I was like, oh wow. And so then, from that led to, okay, I need to be there in a more permanent way, and you know, I also, I learned and made mistakes doing that too. So in 2016, I actually was like, okay, how am I going to do this? I'm such a young company. I can't go to the bank and get a loan. So I started talking to people and I was able to find a company that wanted to help by investing in and becoming a shareholder in Music at Work, my company. So it was a publishing company from Holland that basically bought 25% of my company. But it was so young that there was like not that much value there yet. But they were also willing to give me a loan so that I could find a place in Los Angeles and be that, you know, that bicontinental company that I wanted to be.
That's amazing.
And yeah, so I was able to do that, found this house in Los Angeles, and which, you know, now 7 years later, we still have, thank God, rent it, but I don't own it, but that doesn't matter. It's such a wonderful place in the hills in Laurel Canyon, where all the famous West Coast music was made, from the Fleetwood wow. Mac to Jackson Brown and the Eagles and
history,
all of that stuff.
Then. Yeah.
All of it, it's there. You feel it as well when you're there. You really do feel it. And we got this place. My clients started going there all the time. And the funny thing is, the ones from Holland that once they started using that house in Laurel Canyon, also the quality of their songs also went up. Oh. It was just like, yeah, because of the vibe and because a lot of people, when they go to Los Angeles for a couple of weeks, they hop every day to another place and another studio and another writer. And in this case, you already have the vibe in the house and the studios in there, and the people come to you, and really, really adds to the just overall quality of everything.
It sounds like a much better experience. And they, you know, like when people go to places to write books or to create something, it feels like it's just that you give them the complete experience. No stress with commuting and whatever, and so they have their space and can create freely from there. That's perfect.
Yeah, that's exactly what that was, and that was amazing. Little did I know, though, that the company that I that invested in Music at Work was also not a match for me. It's a long story. I'm not for this podcast, maybe for another time. But, a bunch of things happened and it turned and you realize like, okay, this is not the right match, right? I can't, we don't have the same vision. And there was lots of questions and things that frustrated me that, you know, said, well, okay, these people are not seeing what I'm seeing. And long story short, they basically, you know, only maybe it was 7 or 8 months after we started this thing, they said, you know what, why don't you find somebody else for our 25%? I'm like, oh, okay. And by this time I'm like, that's kind of what I wanted to. So I'm like, okay, how do we do that? And they're like, well, you just pay back what we paid. I'm like, okay. So then I went on a 6 month search for like, how do I find funding that I can like pay back these guys that invested in my company so I can have 100% of my shares back. And I found a corporate crowdfunding service called Knap in Holland, and they helped me out, and we did this little auction, and it was sold out in 4 minutes. And I got the funding, and I was able to pay back what those people invested, and since then I have 100% of my company.
Amazing!
Again. So, wow! And that was 6 years ago now. So. A learning experience, right? You know, very much so. I mean, I'm still thankful for the opportunity because it allowed me to grow and now we still have the house in Los Angeles, and now we even have the place in Berlin as well. And we've really become this multinational company. And the two guys that I originally got the house for, Kimo and Rick, because they were going there so often, they actually live in Los Angeles now. They're permanent there for 4 years. So, you know, that whole thing was meant to, you know, eventually get them there as well. And now they're successful songwriter producers in Los Angeles. So
that's so cool. Yeah. Rick.
It's very nice.
Amazing. And, you also teamed up with the Nordic Music Partners. I heard, and which is which kind of is another touch point that we both share in our mutual contact, Riku. Riku Saloma, and that's so funny because I met him last year when we celebrated the birthday of a very good friend of us, Tuomo Tehtinen, who is the he's the managing director of Full Steam Agency in Finland. And he celebrated his birthday in Barcelona, and I met Riku, and we spent some 4 days together, and we talked about life and everything. And then when we connected, I saw, I think on LinkedIn, that you both were connected, and I was like, huh, interesting. And now you work together, and, you know, and there's a tradition in this podcast that I love to, you know, get some surprise feedback for my guests. And if you don't mind, I would like to play you some.
Oh God!
Here you go.
Yeah, it was fun to hear that you guys know each other with Rick, but considering your careers and wide networks, I'm not so surprised after all. But anyway, about Rick, we've actually been business partners now for a bit over a year. So that's the Nordic Music Partners, the music publishing company. He runs the activity in Amsterdam. I run it here in Helsinki. And together we run the whole group of Nordic Music Partners. Obviously he's impressive career gives us a lot of assets, and it's really valuable for our business and highly valued in the community of Nordic Music Partners. Other than that, Rick is a great guy, great company, so much fun, you know, to hang out with on and off music. So also on the free time of things, so to speak. Thanks. And I wish you a great discussion with Rick.
So that's Rico.
That's so nice. Yeah, that's funny. We talk a lot. I mean, there's a lot going on with Nordic Music Partners, which is another company. So, you know, it's another company we started, like you said, a year ago, but it's been going on for longer. Actually, it goes back to the LA house, actually. So that's connects us because I was there with my client Yoshi Brain in November of 2019. And that's he had a session with Andreas Schuller and Teemu Brunila. And that went so well that they actually called me downstairs. I was upstairs working, and they called me down in the studio. They said, oh, we've had such a great session and we're getting along so well. And Yoshi's like, Teemu and Andreas have this idea, this concept, and you need to hear about it. And it was their vision of Nordic Music Partners originally, which, you know, was the idea of, you know, Finland and Norway have plenty to bring to the table. We don't need Sweden. Literally.
Fair enough.
That was sort of like the funny initial thing. And it, true, because, you know, and Sweden's already got so much going for them in the music scene. But and so does Norway and Finland. But it was a way of basically, I mean, the basic idea is, you know what? We're all successful writers. We all have publishers, but what do those publishers really do for us? In the end, not that much. They go out there and they collect money for a songwriter. That's what a publisher does. But oftentimes, that's all they do. Sometimes there's a little of creative service. Sometimes there's some added value, but oftentimes there isn't. And the concept for Nordic Music Partners is that this is a publishing company that is run and owned by the actual successful songwriters themselves. And that's the difference. So it's a multinational publishing company that is located in four countries, four cities, actually, Helsinki, Oslo, Amsterdam, Paris, although Los Angeles should just be added anyway, because half of our people work and live there.
Yeah.
But like myself. And but the difference is people that get signed to Nordic Music Partners can actually get developed by the people that have written the hits for Madonna and Dua Lipa and JP Cooper, and also write together with those people. So all the partners, the creative partners in Nordic Music Partners, are successful songwriters. And then the people that get signed there write together with them as well, learn how to write the better hit songs.
So that's that kind of mentoring then.
Yeah, very much so. And what's brilliant about it is not just mentoring. The partners can actually help create the hit.
Yeah.
You know, so themselves. So you have a very physical impact on the actual thing, because
very
you can be there.
Yeah.
Create the actual hit together with the people that you're signing, and that, you know, that to me was instant. Like, of course, that's the best.
It makes total sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. It's the best sales pitch you can come up with, and many, many songwriters are jumping in and signing up with us because of that, and not just that mentoring. On top of that, everybody already has a crazy network,
exactly,
a network of international success. Everybody. And then, like, I'm involved, so I'm not the songwriter, but I'm a business partner. But I also have this crazy network that goes back, 20, 30 years in Los Angeles, Europe, everything. Everybody's brings that to the table. So it's a wonderful company. It's brand new. It took us a long time to put together because it's based in four countries. The amount of things that we had to think about is enormous, to be tax compliant in four countries. There's a structure of six companies where there's a mother company that owns the subsidiaries, and then there's a separate company that owns the intellectual property, and all of these companies have to have agreements between each other. It was an incredible year to year and a half of putting that together, from the drawing board to actually incorporating. And now we're off and running.
Wow, that pretty sounds cool. Really exciting. And wish you nothing but the best for this. And of course, for everything you do. And but I don't doubt anything that you do. So you'll do.
Well, thank you.
You'll do.
I mean, you know, you asked at the earlier, was there already a master plan? No, there was not a master plan. And that's,
of course, not
the thing that's the best thing I could probably, give to you and your listeners. And, that it's a discovery. It's all a discovery. Every day's a learning experience. Still for me, every day learning. I'm just telling you now about Nordic Music Partners. I'm having conversations that I could never have had 2 years ago. From both a corporate, just from a company standpoint, but how do you do something like this? To also, what does it mean to be a publisher? I mean, I wasn't a publisher before, really, and now I am, and finding all kinds of additional, learning so much from that end.
And everything our business gets together. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, our business is, I won't get too much in the weeds, but, you have labels and you have publishers, and those are two very different things, right? Labels invest in recordings and sign artists, and publishers invest in songwriters. And those aren't necessarily always the same people, right? Sometimes they are. But a lot of times there's songwriters that then play songs with artists that need songs to sing, or to perform. And anyway, so that's it. It's quite a different type of work, but it's wonderful and very rewarding, and also very much in that creative the creation part, right? So basically the song is where it all begins.
Yeah.
Right? Because without a song there's nothing. So the songwriters, luckily, over the last few years have been getting more and more and more leverage and more respect and in the music community. It's kind of been, it always was sort of like a, oh yeah, those are just the songwriters kind of attitude.
What would happen without them, right? So there are so many world stars that don't write their own songs.
And sometimes they, especially like in the DJ community, that's of course very, very common, because those are they're mainly beat makers or, producers. They're not your traditional songwriters on with a guitar and singing, right? So, DJs need songwriters, and songwriters need DJs. Very naturally, actually. And that's part of how Music at Work became a fairly successful business, is we were marrying a lot of those two worlds. And that's why there's a lot of dance music that we're involved in, simply because it's just an easy match,
And now that you mentioned so many big names, I was wondering, what did you personally learn from being with those people that are highly successful in their careers, music-wise? And what did you learn in terms of that you could use for your own career?
Good question. To be honest, I learned I want to be very careful with my time and my loved ones, because a lot of things that, you see lots of artists lose themselves, become very unhappy, lonely. It's a tough existence sometimes, because you're from every day from one place to the next, and this and that, and you get, everybody wants something from you, and there's a lot of distrust and other things like that. It's not always an existence that you want to emulate. If anything, I would say I learned to value that what I have.
That's a very good point. Happy to hear that from you. Last week, I had a conversation on this podcast with Becky Fontaine and Nathan Gray. Nathan Gray is the lead, they're both in the band called Iron Roses. And Nathan Gray also is the lead singer of Boys That's Fire, which you might know. I don't know. It's a post-hardcore band, like 25 years old. And so I've been discussing with them, and they've been super open about all their struggles in their lives, depression, coming out, and so many things that have been very deep. But they all said that it was super important to stay close with their loved ones and make sure that they stay connected and stay grounded. And of course, they are not on a level that you could compare with, I don't know, big names in the industry, like super well-known pop stars or something like that, that have been in another dimension. But everybody has their shits to deal with. And I think it's super important to have the right people aside to you. That goes for everybody. And what you also said...
No, that's interesting that's what they said too. We, my wife actually at our office, she's the wellness officer at my company.
Yeah, that's a good word.
And that also comes from, seeing these artists, very much similar to what you're just saying. In the DJ world, it's even worse. Because they can do multiple shows on a night, they can do multiple in a weekend, they're flying all over the place. It's incredibly stressful, and there's a lot going on. So having seen that firsthand, that's an interesting service that we have at our company, but also for the people that work at my company. Mental health, luckily now has become a common thing to talk about. It wasn't 5 or 10 years ago, really. No.
I totally relate to that. And I think for me, without going there too long, but I had, I worked in the creative industry for like 22 years now, becoming an art director, moving on to retouching and going all in on that, working with very interesting people, meeting all sorts of clients and agencies and stuff. But the pressure was always very high, and it was always something that I had really had to get used to dealing with this. There was one time that my head almost exploded, literally, with a brain fever, and I had to rethink everything. And that only was possible because I had Anna, my wife, and she was there, and she actually understood what was going on. And I just saw the next job, and I wanted to move on because I'm so passionate about what I do. And I didn't even feel that it was work, and not I didn't feel the stress, but it was way too much. And I guess that happens a lot to creatives, and of course musicians, with having the polarity of being on and off stage. And that was exactly what Nathan said, that he only felt good when he was on stage. Off stage he was miserable all the time, and drunk and having issues with everything. And I bet that you, having seen so much of this, you can be not only great in accompanying them in a professional way, but also as a person, and giving them the experience of everything that you saw and you experienced with all the other people that you worked with, which is super valuable.
Sure. I mean, maybe another thing to share that's sort of tangential to that is, but it is about mental health, and that is, you know, my COVID moment was, you know, now what, 3.5 years ago, right? When it hit. But before that, I was actually representing a very successful DJ. But I was doing everything for him. I was his manager, his record label, his publisher, his legal team, and it was an incredible, ridiculous amount of service that we were providing. Oh, something that sounds, normally is like eight jobs, eight different people, or eight companies if you own one.
And you did that all.
And because I could, or I knew how to, right? I mean, yeah. I have the capacity to do all those things, and it was very appealing to think, oh, well, then we could do this, and then we could do that. And next thing I know, I'm doing all of these things. And but he was a incredibly as a lot of these DJs are, very demanding person, and would claim my attention and my work, on a constant basis. But I was not exclusive to him. I also had six other clients, right?
Yeah.
But of course he didn't care. So like there was always this just like, you know, me is constant, and I was always giving because, you know, I was doing these eight jobs, and I didn't know how to set my boundaries.
Okay.
And one day I realized that, and then I actually started talking to somebody about that, right? Like, hey, you know, good. I feel like I need to develop a way to be able to do this, because I'm being used and lived, and I'd never spoken to anybody before, like in a sort of a therapy session type situation. It was fascinating because it really changed. Well, it allowed me to discover for myself what it is that I really needed and wanted. And, then COVID happens, and it's like 3 or 4 months after I started like the search for, you know, this way to set my boundaries. And I woke up one day and I realized, you know what, this guy, he's never going to value the fact that I'm doing eight jobs, not so much money or whatever, but the fact that I can do that, he's not even seeing that value. No. That means I'm always going to be disappointed because I'm not going to be valued the way I feel I should be. I'm not going to walk around every day disappointed. So I'm going to end this now. And that was my realization. And that was the best decision I ever made. You know, and it was very difficult at the time. We still ended up working together. I took one of the jobs that I said, okay, I'll still do this job. And the other seven, you can find somebody else for. And
how did that go? How was the reaction?
The reaction was, you know, not happy at first at all.
But did he realize what you were actually doing for him?
I don't know if he ever did. No, I mean, yes, maybe, probably, yes. I mean, I think so.
But in the end, it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is that you are good with this.
Exactly, and that was, you know, that was the best thing, and it was a difficult time, but so was everything. COVID, we had to change. Everybody had to change.
Tell me about that.
change everything, right? It was so. I took that as a you know a moment to change that all up and change that narrative, and you know, a week after I made that decision. One of the nicest guys in the music business, Jonas Kroper, walked into my office, and we've been together ever since, and had hit records around the world together. So, you know, it was 180 degrees. The other example,
you were rewarded for the decision that you took.
Yeah,
taking care of yourself, and I guess that's a big lesson I learned.
Yeah,
and it's super important to realize that.
Yeah,
and to honor that.
No, 100%. No, 100%. So cool. You know, also what you were saying about the kindness thing earlier, that has definitely been, you know, my belief in life, you know, is you get back from the universe what you put into it, right? And that's sort of that same principle. And, you know, and whenever I get disappointed or I have an art, you know, I always believe in the end, like, that's always going to win out. And maybe that means I don't get like some artist signed to me because I'm not, you know, the bullshit guy that's promising all this shit, or, you know, I'm not that type of a person, you know. That's fine. You know, but what you do get is always transparency and honesty and pureness. And that's, funnily enough, a bit unique in our business.
I believe you. But I guess the most important thing is to realize who you really are and being you and just doing you. And as I got to know you back then, you were that really kind, caring, fun guy that kind of had everything in control. And, I heard today that you had this wonderful like career moving on from there and bringing all the experience you had from the big labels and from the touring the world into your new business. And I'm very thankful for you sharing all this with me and with the community. And I'm super happy that we just connected again and have this conversation. I know we are running short on time and I don't want to take away any more from you. I just have this.
I have to pack for my vacation. Very important.
Oh, where do you go then?
Go to the island. Yeah, we go to the island of Naxos every year, one of the Greek islands.
Oh, nice.
And not a lot of people know about it. It's a big island, but it doesn't have any of the. It doesn't have any international flights. Only flights to Athens. So, I think that's why a lot of people don't know about it. But my wife and I discovered it 6-7 years ago, and in September, so we like to go after, you know, everybody's left.
That's
it's
a good decision.
It's still really nice weather. It's still like 25, 26, I think, there every day now.
Yeah, and it has been quite warm there this year, right? And
well, that was too warm, so this is perfect now.
Yeah. Exactly. Hey,
Eric, you had a question for me, though.
Yeah, I do have a question from Nathan and Becky from the Iron Roses.
Oh, cool!
Without them knowing that it was you, the next, or everybody asked the question for the next person. But they ask, do you create from joy or from pain, and how can you challenge yourself to create from the place opposite your comfort zone?
Ooh, wow!
That's a tough one.
Yeah, no, that is a very interesting question. Jesus Christ. Thanks, guys. I think both. I do a lot of sharing. So I'm a positive, optimistic guy. So there's definitely a lot of operating from joy that I do / I enjoy it, obviously, for obvious reasons. But no, the pain aspect is real. And Probably more learning experience. I think probably most people would say that, right? The hardships are where you really learn and you build character and grow. Yeah, I think part of that was in the story I told earlier, right?
Sure.
And like having going back down to the ground level, if you will, and building back up again.
I can totally relate to that, and that's so important to share this. I think for me, I really had two hard setbacks in my career, having to like two breakups in two companies I founded. And but it made me realize who I really am and what I can give and what I want to share with the world. And in the end, I couldn't be in a better place. But I had to go through this valleys of pain and misery, so to say, without, like, as you said, that touching the ground with my face first. And but it's, I think it's these moments when you stand up again and you wipe the dust off your shoulders and you say, okay, what can I do now? And then one of my favorite bands of all time comes to my mind, that Maximo Park. They always said that what happens when you lose everything, you just start again, you just start all over again and apply some pressure. Mm. That was one of the songs that got me going a lot. And I think that's what life is about. You have to have the experiences, learn from it. Some people need it the hard way. I needed it the hard way, but it certainly gets you grounded and makes you grow as a person. And I don't know. I think that's what I took from that. And
really interesting.
You said the same.
Yeah, no, it's I guess if you've been around long enough, you have these stories, right?
You have.
But it's, and there's also so many other cliches that we could keep on going. You know, I mean, getting older is so much more fun than I ever knew. You know, it's like I don't even want to. I wouldn't want to be my 35-year-old self at the moment. You know, and for, you know, because that guy didn't know shit.
Well,
so, you know, and so there's fun in wisdom and all of that. You know, I guess, you know, you can almost hear old people talk now, like, oh, things were better back in the day. That's not what I mean, but it's fun. It's one of the fun reasons to be in this business, actually, is that, you know, always in dealing with something new, and there's always a new excitement and a new creation and a new energy. And, you know, working with a lot of young people is also exciting, but they also have a lot to learn. So
and that's what this is all about. And there is where it comes full circle here. So thank you for all the input, the inspiration, for the great stories you told, for sharing your career, and of course for your time, and for making 2000 happen when we met. And God knows what happens next. But this was amazing, Rick. Thank you for everything. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Jan. Good luck with your show.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening, and thank you for diving deep into that one day that Rick and me met back in Sydney, 2000. It was fascinating to connect after 23 years and to have that really nice conversation and getting to know Rick even more and what has happened over the last 23 years. I hope you enjoyed the ride. And if you want to reach out to Rick, you can find the Instagram profile and his work profile and his LinkedIn profile in the show notes. There you will also find his quickfire question answers and the question that he left for you guys. So check it out in the show notes and in the respective Instagram posts. Wishing you nothing but the best. And if you found any value in this episode, please consider subscribing to the podcast, giving it a 5-star rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. That would help so much and support the show to rank higher and reach more people to get inspired, motivated, and to connect on that podcast. So that would be highly appreciated. Thank you very much. And should you know anyone that could be benefiting from this podcast or from the episodes that you've heard so far, please forward the show to your friends and recommend it on social. And until then, wishing you nothing but the best. Take care and hear you next time.